doing the Texas two-step this week. Houston, College Station, providing coverage for USA Today. Find his work online, usatoday.com. Become a follower on Twitter. Use the handle at George Schroeder. We welcome in George Schroeder. George, how are you on this fine Wednesday, sir?
Man, I'm doing good. How are you?
All is well. All is well. One of these topics that seems to be resurfacing, satellite camps. We talked about the role of Jim Harbaugh. Now it appears the U.S. Department of Justice may get involved. I know there was a piece by your colleague, Paul Meyerberg, an informal inquiry, calls to coaches, administrators, conference commissioners. Why would the DOJ have an interest in an issue like this?
Well, I'm not completely convinced that will go anywhere. I do think this. I think it's a bit of a I think they might get a little interested, but it's a bit of a probably from some people who are for satellite camps who have maybe they're pushing the angle that we've heard that, look, as much as satellite camps help these schools out who go to other areas away from their campuses and have these camps, it helps kids out because it gives them an opportunity to be seen by coaches. We've all heard that argument. You and I have talked about that argument on the air. You've talked about it with other people. And so the DOJ, to the extent that they're interested, would be interested in, is this a ruling that is depriving opportunities for prospective students? And to me, it gets a little thin there in terms of whether the government can get involved with the private organization's decision-making. But a whole lot of state universities and, public universities involved there. So, like I said, I don't know how far it will go. But the fact that they're involved is a real interesting, or even interested in being involved, it's kind of a real interesting piece to this ongoing saga of the story that, A, is what is being blown out of proportion and will never die.
Yeah, it is internal.
The off-season story that will not end, you know what I mean? So.
Absolutely. Now, there's some confusion here in the Pac-12, which voted for the ban, not unanimously. I read a piece in one of the L.A. papers, Dan Guerrero, the UCLA AD, maybe threw a curveball. The league wanted to vote against the ban. He voted in favor. Could you offer some clarification here?
I can try.
On the logic behind his actions and maybe the reaction of Pac-12 Commissioner Larry Scott?
Yeah, well, that's really two pieces to it. First of all, you're right in that 11 of the 12 schools were against a satellite camp ban. One school, which happens to be UCLA, abstained from that vote, didn't go against it, but wasn't for a ban, but wasn't against it. So it was 11-0-1. And in that case, it's my understanding that you're supposed to, when you are the representative on the committee, the Division I Council, happened to be UCLA Athletic Director Dan Guerrero, you are to vote with the 11 because there is a clear direction that the league has shown. If it was 7-5 and you happen to be with the 5, you could vote whatever you felt was the best thing to do, because it would be kind of a, wouldn't really be a consensus, even though it would be a majority. In this case, it's 11-0-1. And so the other athletic directors in the league believed he should have voted against the ban. But it gets a little more complicated than that, in that there were two different proposals put forth by the ACC, which banned them all, and that's the proposal that passed, by the SEC, which would have allowed you to hold satellite camps put on by the school itself in your own state, or if you're close to another state, you could do it within a 50-mile radius of your school if it crossed the border. So, like, if you're, Portland State, you could do it in Vancouver or somewhere a little farther north than
okay.
that, right?
Yeah.
But Oregon couldn't go into Seattle. Not that they'd want to, but, Oregon couldn't go to L.A. So that was the SEC's proposal. And so Guerrero sent out a memo after voting for the SEC proposal, which failed, and the complete ban, the ACC proposal, passed. He sent out a memo saying, I could tell that one of the two was going to pass, and so I voted for the one that I thought was less bad. He voted for the ACC proposal, which banned them all, because he thought that the SEC proposal, the one that would allow you to do camps in your own state, would have left the Pac-12 on unequal footing with other conferences. So whether you agree with his reasoning or not, he sent out this memo that was distributed to the other athletic directors of Pac-12 saying that here's why I did what I did. Now, there are some athletic directors who still believe he should have just voted against all of them.
Right.
Both of them, regardless of whether you thought they were going to pass or whatever, just do what is the sort of the sentiment of the league. So they weren't happy with him.
Right.
All of that to say, so last week I'm in Dallas in Irving, Texas, actually at the College Football Playoffs annual meetings, and Larry Scott comes out and says, and it certainly appeared like he was waiting to say it, came right over to us to want to talk, which doesn't always happen with the commissioners, basically said Dan Guerrero didn't vote the way he was supposed to vote.
Whoa.
And at that point, that's just not something you hear. You know, I'm kind of a veteran now of these kind of gatherings. These guys are real careful. Whatever they feel internally, they're real careful about taking family squabbles outside. They keep them inside. You know what I mean? They don't have the family squabble. They don't do what the Big 12 does with the foreign. but those are very unusual moments. And when a commissioner calls out an athletic director over a vote, it was essentially like he ran the bus over him and then backed it up because he kept talking about it. I actually came back to it and asked him. I said, I just want to make sure I understand this. Did you just say that that Dan Guerrero should have voted the other way, but he voted the wrong way? And he said yes, and he sort of expounded on it. And, you know, so at that point, now you've got athletic directors who are unhappy with the way Dan Guerrero voted, who are way more unhappy with what Larry Scott did to Dan Guerrero. That's a three-minute version that could have gone 10 minutes, and hopefully everybody didn't get all messed up when I was trying to explain the two different satellite bands. But basically, you've got athletic directors mad or unhappy with Dan Guerrero the way he voted, but way more unhappy inside the league. Not all of them, and I haven't spoken to all of them, but several of them I have spoken with, way more unhappy with what Larry Scott said.
I gotcha. Larry Scott, by the way, would be a perfect Tannen family member. If my mom has a problem with my uncle and we happen to be at a restaurant, doesn't matter. It's all coming out.
He's an honorary Tannen. I mean, I've got to tell you, my jaw might have almost dropped because it was so unusual for anybody to say something like that, even if that's what they think. Even if you'd called a few people and they had said, look, I can't be quoted on this, and I don't even want you to say on background, blah, 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 blah. But yes, we're not real happy with him. Nobody ever says that out loud. It was wild.
No, and just getting the gist on Twitter, that's what I got. All right, let's move to the NBA, the Thunder and the Mavericks season. Mark Cuban makes a comment that there's one superstar, Kevin Durant. I know it's gamesmanship, but I don't buy that an owner can get in an opponent's head. They're your hometown team. We know Kevin Durant is top 2, 3, 4 player in the league. I'm kind of curious, how do the fans in Oklahoma City kind of rate or embrace Westbrook, who I would say is a superstar?
Well, I mean, I think Durant is one of the, as you said, top 2, 3, or 4 players in the league. I wouldn't drop very much farther beyond that for Russell Westbrook. Frankly, parts of this season and last, when, and of course, obviously, KD was out most of last season with a foot injury, he was better. And so, I mean, he's clearly a top five. They have two of the top five players in the league. To say he's not a superstar is just, it is gamesmanship, but it's also just goofy.
Yeah.
And I think it made him mad. And I'll tell you what else it did. I don't know that Kevin Durant's going anywhere in free agency. That's going to be the big storyline that consumes as soon as the Thunder are out, you know, of the playoffs, whenever that is, whether they, you know, go out to the Spurs or the Warriors or whether they make it to the finals or whatever. It's going to be the storyline for June is, you know, what does Kevin Durant do? Does he stay or not? But I'll tell you one place he's not going. If you heard or read what he said after the game the other night when they closed out the series against the Mavericks, and somebody asked him, or they asked Russell,
yep,
about the comments that Cuban made, and Durant basically answered instead, and called Mark Cuban an idiot. Said he's an idiot, which that's also something you don't hear players say very often. And by the way, that's also not the way Kevin Durant is. You can tell it fired him up. He's
sure.
A pretty mild-mannered, soft-spoken guy. You know, for him to take up for his buddy like that and to call out an owner was pretty wild, too. So I say all that to say, my guess is we are not going to see Kevin Durant go to Dallas, even if he goes somewhere other than Oklahoma City next year. He will not be a Maverick.
That seems like a pretty safe bet.
Yep.
Let's get to college football. The spring game's happening. You know, you visited Houston off. You know, that's their greatest season since I was like in high school in the late 70s under Bill Yeoman, their first year under Tom Herman, who was the offensive coordinator at Ohio State. As one of the very early favorites, as a, you know, one of the non-Power 5 schools, a lot of people talking about those making one of those New Year's Six bowls. How big is the buzz right now in H-Town about Cougar football?
Well, it's pretty big. I mean, to the extent that Cougar football is ever a big buzz in Houston. I mean, you're talking about a big city,
yeah,
with a bunch of pro sports and divided loyalties when it comes to colleges. It's a big A&M and a big Texas town. You know, and then, but that said, there is definitely a buzz about them, and there should be. They've got 12 starters coming back, including Greg Ward Jr., a quarterback who's one of the more dynamic players in the country. They went 13-1 last year, as you referenced. You know, won the New Year's Six Peach Bowl over Florida State.
Yep.
You know, there's every reason to suspect that they've got a shot at making another run to be that best group of five team to get to the New Year's Six Bowl. But I think they're kind of like wondering, could there be something more in the offing? I think this is really seriously unlikely for a lot of reasons, but they opened the season with Oklahoma at NRG Stadium in Houston. So it's a neutral site game, air quotes, right? It's a neutral site game, but it's in Houston. Then later in the year, they've got Louisville also at home. It's a Thursday night game. Everybody will be watching. That's in November. In between that, they have the American schedule, which is not a bad schedule. It's, you know, it's better, frankly, than some ACC schedules you'll see. And if they were to somehow beat Oklahoma, which is going to be a top five team going into the season, and I'm guessing Houston will be 10, 11, 12, something like that, 13, and then run the table, you're going to have to, and especially if Oklahoma then did damage in the Big 12 and maybe even won it, you're going to hear a whole lot of people saying Houston deserves a shot at the playoff. And I'm not saying I agree. I am saying that they've got a shot for that to be in that conversation.
Wow, that's bold. Yeah, I was reading about them. That's become a really terrific program. Ironically, you then went and visited Texas A&M, where, of course, Kevin Sumlin came from Houston and had a 13-1 season when he joined the Aggies. Of course, his first year at A&M, Manziel wins the Heisman. They won 11 games, then 9, then 8. Then eight. I had a conversation with a caller who said since Manziel left, A&M's been 4-4, 3-5, 4-4 in conference. So why should we believe they will be more than an average SEC program moving forward?
I don't think there's any real evidence to believe that, other than you look at sort of maybe the talent they're amassing and you think maybe they'll put it together one year, which will sort of feed momentum or fuel momentum to go farther. But based on their history, and you can go back further than the SEC, they had the one blip year with Johnny Manziel, and about 2 or 3 years before that, they had a nice year in the Big 12. But you can go back 20 years except for that nice year in the Big 12 and except for the Johnny Manziel first year, which is 2012. You can go back 20 years before they were really a factor in anything. So I don't have any issue if anybody wants to tell you I'm not going to believe in Texas A&M until they do something. Zero issue in that. I completely agree with that. And this is a really big year for Kevin Sumlin because I think the Aggies' expectations have been overinflated, and last year especially they didn't meet those inflated expectations, and that's a big problem. Because regardless of whether expectations are inflated or not, that's what they are. And so they're going to have to be better or, you know, they may make a change.
Wow. That's something that so you had this conversation 3 years ago when he was one of the up and coming quarterbacks, coaches. Kind of surprising. So just I'll leave with this. They had Kyle Allen, Kyler Murray did most of the work at quarterback last year. Now Trevor Knight transferred in from Oklahoma. How does the quarterback picture or depth chart shape up for Kevin Sumlin right now?
Yeah, well, he's named Trevor Knight at the end of spring practice. He named Trevor Knight, the Oklahoma transfer, as a starter.
Oh.
Which is a good thing probably off the field, because Trevor Knight is as good a leader as I've ever seen, and I've gotten a chance to know him a little bit from when he was at Oklahoma. He's, you know, on the field, however, which goes back to what we're talking about, he's been inconsistent. So I think there's a big question mark there. He won the job over Jake Kubenak, who was the guy who played the bowl game for them. But you referenced Kyler Murray and Kyle Allen. Kyle Allen leaves in December, announces he's transferring, and leaves as the starting quarterback before the bowl game. He makes Kyler Murray the starter, and he decides he's going to leave about 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 days later before the bowl game. The quarterbacks transfer. We all know that. If you don't win the job, you transfer. That's the position where they do that. But starting quarterbacks don't transfer, and starting quarterbacks don't transfer before a season's over, and the next guy up doesn't then transfer. And I think a whole lot of people looked at that, and then Kevin Sumlin also fired his offensive coordinator and switched things up and hired Noah Mazzone from UCLA. They look at a lot of those things and think, wow, what kind of dissension was there last year? You know, now, from their standpoint, they're like 5 months later, what kind of stability is there now? And, you know, it's all which side of it you look at, I suppose.
No, it's very odd circumstance. But as always, fun stuff. Catch George at usatoday.com, on Twitter, at George Schroeder. You travel safe from Texas back to Oklahoma, and we look forward to catching up once again next week.
All right. Thanks, man.
Thank you, sir.